Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. Despite what it says on your paperwork, I actually retired from Natural England in March this year, so I can say that I'm not that. But what I wanted to do was just describe some of the work I was doing prior to retirement. And really, I've been working with species, with monitoring. I've been a recorder for probably 50 years. And experience with nature conservation and biodiversity. Because I think the big question perhaps we need to put into the pot today is we're focusing on detection of species, the range of taxonomic data, etc. But one of the things that considerably concerns us is we can prove to the nth degree that biodiversity is declining. We know that. We've got the message. The big question is, why is it declining and what might we do about it? Because, as you know, when I worked for government, they put an awful lot of money into biodiversity. We used to give farmers £1 million a day to do biodiversity benefit, yet it's still declining. So really, where I was coming from, looking at monitoring and survey, etc., was to try and understand why things are declining. And one of the twists I'll put into this is that I'm perhaps more interested in assemblies and communities than I am in species, because with climate change and natural evolution, it's the communities which change, not necessarily worrying about individual species. You know, we know which country the stamp comes from, but I want to know how the postal system is changing and how it might influence that. So I'll take you through some of the things that we did prior to my retirement. And I apologise that some of this is slightly out of date, but hopefully not too out of date. And if I'm wrong, I've got a colleague in the audience who put me right. But basically, we all accept that species are fundamental to nature conservation. Getting the right name on the species, as we've already heard, is really, really important. That's why taxonomists are necessary and will continue to be so. But the problem we're having is there's a traditional focus on a few popular taxa. You know, you heard right at the start from Richard, there's an awful lot of evidence about declines and which you're doing and which species, but we're still dealing with a very, very small percentage. When I started the DNA work, I had a friend who said, oh, it'd be really useful, except, you know, things like except fungus gnats. Well, the reason why fungus gnats aren't regarded as conservationally important is because there's only probably one person in the UK who can really confidently identify them. Yet there's over 500, 600 species. They could be brilliant in communities and assemblages at telling you about the change in wetlands, etc. So we need to think outside that box about what we mean by traditional. There's also that very strong reliance on biological recorders, and I put that as a but. It's also a strength, but it can be a weakness, because we're encouraging biological recorders to concentrate more and more records on those popular taxa. If we looked and analysed the photographs coming into these schemes, the vast majority of those are with things like butterflies that people have seen in their garden, or moths they've found on a wall. So we need to be aware of that. There's also, despite what we've said, there is a small and dwindling expert community. Those of us who have been around for a while in this field, no, we've lost so many colleagues, so many friends, we're real experts. And there isn't really any in education. We don't do whole organism in education. We don't do taxonomy in schools and universities. It has to be picked up afterwards or as some particular thing. That's still there as a big issue. Also, as Richard has said, we don't have, often I've said, poor status. For 95% of our priority species, we don't actually know what's happening to them. We worry too much about those little minutiae. It may be critical, it may not be. We have very, very poor assemblage and community data. We've got the National Vegetation Classification for plants, but we have nothing for anything else of any consequence. Yet this is probably where the changes are being manifest. As climate change warms places, makes different places wetter, the assemblages will change. It's inevitable. As an ecologist, you know that's going to happen. Are we actually managing for habitats to support those new communities? I think not. And the most important one to me is that Joe has talked about trying to mobilise and make this data accessible. My experience up until March last year is actually this was going backwards when we were asked by the biological, the BSBI, to take their data from our systems as a government agency because they were not willing to make all that data openly available without actually more and more support. So it is still a big issue. We mustn't. There's a big elephant in the room you mustn't walk away from. Right, now DNA. I did microbiology in my student days. I knew a little bit about DNA. I remember trying to extract it and do various things. But I once went to a meeting with an academic group who actually took me through what was possible now. They sent me some of these papers. And reading those papers on the journey from Peterborough to London to meet them, it was like the road to Damascus. I did not understand what had been going on. I didn't comprehend the advances that had been made, and particularly around invertebrates, because like Martin, I'm a closet entomologist, perhaps. I've never worked as one, but it's always been my interest. So what I was interested in here is this is a new data source. It has new potential. If you get it right, it is unique at telling you what a species is. You know, the little coloured bars you've seen, those are base sequences which are red, and they're absolutely the same for every single barn owl that is that barn owl species. They're different from other species. So that's the sort of thing that we need to optimise. And really, it is about this unique species identification. But more importantly, by looking at some of the barcodes and using them in different ways, you can drag out of that data immense information on communities and similarities. And we're doing an enormous amount of this around soil communities at present, for instance. And the basic process is, technically, it's very easy. I can say that as a non-microbiologist, but there is a process. It's a well-honed process. It's well understood. And I was assured when I went to this work that almost anything is possible. As you'll see, there are things which still need to be worked out. But technically, there is no reason why you can't actually extract DNA for any species from anywhere. It's just a matter of getting the right technique, getting the right primers. But the really sad thing is there's a process of seven stages here. The only one that we, as conservationists, as species identifiers, can really engage in is the sampling end. So one of the things that made the big difference when we started was to build a very powerful partnership. It was literally a co-funded exercise with what was a commercial company, but it had just recently been established by a group of academics, one of whom I thought might have been here today, Alfred, who is actually interested in this area. So we were building our skills about what species were, what conservation, what the questions were, with the technical skills of the academics. And that was what, to me, was quite interesting and unique. So they did stages 2 to 7, and we advised them on what we'd like to see, where we would sample, how we would sample, what material. And perhaps the thing I'm emphasising here is the word eDNA is thrown around a lot as just about DNA. Environmental DNA is traces of DNA in the wider environment. It isn't the organism. In other words, if I take a sample of water, there's fragments of DNA from the organisms which live there. If I take a fly and take a leg off, that's real DNA. And there's quite a distinction. It's much easier to take the leg off the fly than if you dip a pot into the water. So what we did, rather than do big literature searches and try and convince ourselves it's the right thing before we invested, we made a relatively small investment. I think at the end of the year, I probably spent something like £40,000, which might sound a lot, but in terms of government spend and research, it's just peanuts. But what we did is we took a series of issues, a series of habitats, if you like, and we began to look at what we might be able to do with DNA in these different environments. Because what we wanted to do was to see and test what it could do now and what the issues were. So even if it didn't work, we were laying the ground for moving forward. So that was the basic principle. So we were asking questions like, you know, can DNA detect species in different situations? Are there things which stop us detecting them? Can we get better data from this? Because one of the things that we were concerned about, we were constantly fighting, trying to get access to information, and that information was very partial and there were lots of biases in it, to getting lots and lots of information. You know, I'd rather have, as an entomologist, I've spent a lot of my time both doing and commissioning work, going out and looking for things. So you turn up on a site, it's raining. You look around for a few hours, you find a few things, and you come back and write a report on the site. That is so risky. It's so random of what you're going to find and what you're going to see. I eventually decided that one of the best ways to do it, and you'll see some in a minute, was to stick up and use some of these standardised trapping methodologies that anyone can use. You know, using audio counters as an app on your phone is an excellent extension of that concept. A standard way that anyone can use, collect the material. The issue of using those standard traps was then you're left with the problem identification. And that's where I think this comes into it. So So let's look at some of those areas. The three aspects we tried to explore around freshwater monitoring. One was seeing whether we could detect dragonfly assemblages in ponds. And this was because when we designate protected sites, one of the features we have, for instance, is a dragonfly assemblage. And it's quite difficult to commission someone to confirm, you know, every 5 years or whatever, that the dragonfly assemblage is still good. If we could literally take a water sample out of a pond, squirt it through a little filter, which comes in a really nice kit, it's dead easy to do, send that in the post and get the answer. That was really what we were looking for. And I'll talk about how that's worked later. We were also particularly interested in finding target species that are elusive. Things like a spined loach, a little elusive fish that lives in the murky bottoms of ditches and things. And again, we sampled water to see whether we could detect whether the spined loach was there. Because commissioning work to find this, to report, is actually quite expensive. And finally, a similar thing, we were trying to see whether we could detect some of these rare mollusks in ditches using water as well. On the marine side, we thought there's been lots done in freshwater. You know, Natural England was a bit of a trailblazer about using pond water to detect the presence of great crested newts, and that's now an art form. So we thought, you know, what about all those other things you can get in the water? And so we cast around with some of my colleagues and said, you know, what would you like to know from marine? What would you like to find that you find really difficult now? One of the projects we threw up was looking for, there was a particular small anemone which was in some sea-lined lagoons, which they couldn't find. There was a rare mollusk in the lagoons. There was a little freshwater shrimp in the lagoons. So we thought, well, let's try it. Let's take some water samples. Let's play around with that. Finding seahorses is actually quite difficult, but quite important. These are things which are highly protected now. And we thought, well, could we actually take samples to find whether seahorses are there? And the real interesting one was what's called intertidal sediment. It sounds very dull, but it's the basic food for quite a lot of intertidal feeding birds, etc. And when we do that, we took 20 samples several years ago in the Wash, and these have to be treated and washed through and everything identified. And for those 20 samples or 20 transects, it cost us £90,000. So if we could find a method of sampling those sediments, extracting the individuals we're interested in, and getting the list of them using DNA, that would be a real, real cost-efficient way of doing it. So those were the things we were playing. The standard things that I was interested in is, could I take my 60 gallons of malaise trap material and instead of spending 50 years and God knows how much money farming out the specimens to be identified and then only partially, could we take that malaise trap sample and, as they told me, we could liquidise it and get a species list? You know, that was the golden rule. Because I spent many years trapping using malaise trap, and I assure you, by the time you've done that for 10, 20 years, you never get to the point of doing anything with the data. The focus is just on getting the species lists. And I wanted to work through into those communities. And perhaps one of the more interesting ones was targeting really elusive species in deadwood. And the species we tried to find was the violet click beetle, which at one point was only thought to occur on one tree in Windsor. We now know there's two or three other sites. But it's very, very difficult to find and often involves virtually destroying its habitat to find it. So these were the sort of things we were playing with. Vegetation-wise, again, as a conservation ecologist, if you like, quadrats were the standard way of looking at vegetation. And in Natural England, we have a system of parallels, what CEH does with long-term monitoring, of having sites where we actually, every 4 or 5 years, go back, look exactly the same place, assess the vegetation, see whether it's changed, try and tease out some of these things that are causing biodiversity to change. And when we used to get this quadrat information, we were always unsure how much weight we could put on it, because each observer has biases. They have different skills, different experience. Sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, they're getting a bit tired. And it was actually the thing that stimulated me was going, we were redoing the quadrat, which had been done 4 years previously, by a consultant. And consultants, when you pay for it, are brilliant, aren't they? We were finding consistently 50% more species in the quadrats than were found 4 years ago. That hadn't happened in a 4 year period. It was simply the variation in observer. So one of the things we did is we set out a challenge to some of my botanical colleagues, because we probably have some of the best botanists in the country in what's now called our field unit. And they assessed all these quadrats for me. And I asked them to harvest the vegetation from each of the little cells they checked, and also take some soil samples from the same places. But what we went on to do was to have the vegetation. We've had one of them, we may have more done, but we had one of them analysed using DNA, and we compared it with what they'd observed in the field. And I'll come on to that because it was quite interesting. The soils one, again, if we could simply monitor plant change by taking soil samples, that would be brilliant. And there is evidence you can do that, but I'll come on to what happened. The sort of things we've been finding is when you're looking for invertebrates in fresh water, so far we haven't succeeded in finding dragonfly DNA, mainly because there is so much microbial activity in that water that we need to find a way of filtering that out. It may be we need more specific primers, but that's ongoing, and that it's a challenge the academics are taking forward. The spined loach is a fish, it's dead easy. Fish DNA in water is very, very easy to detect. And not only did it tell us where the spined loach was and wasn't, but it gave us a long list of species of fish in those places and some indication of their relative abundance, which is perhaps even more interesting. Mollusks, we're still waiting to see what's happened. The saline lagoon species, again, in water, the eDNA, the DNA that's excreted or left by invertebrates in water is very, very small. It's very difficult to detect, and it's completely swamped out by non-target DNA. Again, we need to refine the method, so we weren't successful there. Seahorses, we were able to detect very, very easily in aquarium situations where we knew the seahorses were and weren't. When we actually went to Lion Bay and dipped a bucket in the water, we didn't find any. We did find lots of other species of fish, and we suspect we were probably wrong time of year, looking in the wrong place, whatever it was. You can detect things like seahorses simply by taking marine samples, water samples. The intertidal invertebrates, again, this was novel, and I understand, I'm just waiting for the results to come in, but we think there is a species list bodding around there where we've got the animals out. And if that works and we turn into a routine method, it could save enormous amounts of money in actually sampling these things. Terrestrial invertebrates, the malaise trap worked perfectly. I was just amazed at the list of obscure flies and beetles that this method provided. And that is there ready to be used technically. You know, we shouldn't be wading through gallons of glue. We should actually be using these new techniques. Deadwood invertebrates, we didn't find the violet click beetle, mainly because we think it wasn't there. Because the problem with the deadwood is that when we took an old elytra of the violet click beetle to establish the barcode for the violet click beetle, they extracted some beautiful DNA, and it told us that the violet click beetle is a fungus. Because anything in deadwood is immediately invaded by fungus and totally destroyed. So what we were looking for was an egg or a pupa or a small larva in the actual mould. So we're going to stick on with that because we believe there's, you know, an enormous potential here, not just for violet click beetle, but all the other deadwood invertebrates. The vegetation from soils, it has worked. We do have a species list, but again, there are some substantial technical difficulties to work with to get the root material out of the soils. But theoretically, everything in the sward is below ground, and that's what we're hanging on to. So that's continuing. The DNA vegetation, we actually had done by Q, some of David's old colleagues, who told me this wouldn't work. You've collected it in the wrong way. The hay isn't dried sufficiently. So they were absolutely amazed when they got this full list of species. And they said, oh, we've only got 20 species. And I said, okay, that's how you've done. We only recorded 18 species anyways. And we had great correspondence with the DNA and what we observed, with one or two exceptions. And one of the things it did, I walked away from Natural England having lit the blue touch paper around the debate about identifying festucas, because they said they had festuca, rubra and ulvina. And the DNA say absolutely categorically it was only one species. So I think that there's some interesting challenges there. So that's the sort of things which we've got. We also are working with fish detection in lakes, which is quite mature now. We've got lots of developing data on soil community. We're also going to be looking at detecting things like pearl mussels in rivers, pathogens, invasive species, mosquitoes. We can tell you an awful lot about mosquitoes using DNA. And perhaps more interestingly, I'm actually helping to supervise a PhD looking at population genetics of marsh turtles using markers on DNA strands, which is absolutely amazing. It's brilliant. So the benefits of using this will be that we'll get data on a much, much wider range of taxa. That it's limitless what you get. The sampling using standard methods is simple and repeatable. It's completely able to be used by non-experts, people who are interested. There is a very rapid turnaround of results if you get the right system. Literally sampling in the field on a Monday, you can have the results by Friday. So it is possible. I'm not saying it hasn't been done like that, but I have seen with the markets really that happening. Reduced costs for sampling, costs for DNA analysis are just plummeting. There was one academic who very bravely said, if I gave a fragment of a leaf for 50 pence, he'd tell me what it was. Why the use of biometrics? We don't use biometrics on our species data now because we just haven't got the data. We haven't got the volumes of data, apart with quality exceptions, perhaps like birds and butterflies. This provides huge opportunities to be able to distinguish different samples, different sites, different habitats on the basis of their community metrics. And more importantly, it does provide a huge opportunity with citizen science and volunteers. And finally, the things that I think it means for taxonomic expertise is that to say this species and this barcode is correct requires that you've identified the individual in the first place. And this is something, when I was leaving Natural England, I was very keen to try and develop a strong partnership between the biological community and the taxonomists in the naturalist community, and they're really keen to accept specimens, make sure they're correctly named, have them properly archived as voucher specimens. So as we build a UK library, there's excellent libraries being done in Germany and Canada, etc. And we have a huge number of libraries available for the UK, but it would be really good to really document that well. One of the things it does, which we haven't gone into, is provides information on taxonomic relationships. Taxonomy will be revised, but you can't revise the basic DNA. You can understand it more. That species is more closely related to this one. This species is actually four species. When they did this work in Wales, they discovered that the common harebell was actually two species. We didn't know that. So I think there's some really exciting things going to come up. More importantly, by being able to take standard samples, larger sample sizes, you can actually look at the variation across the UK, across Europe, whatever it is. And those larger sample sizes give you greater confidence in whatever trends you're picking up. The people who are doing this, say as a volunteer putting out or collecting a sample, if the information is fed back to them, it should stimulate their interest in actually what's in their environment. Once they begin to realise things like tardigrades, given some support to get interested, they could become the next specialist in tardigrade taxonomy. So it's that sort of thing. And more importantly, when as a taxonomist you're describing a species or redescribing it, it's fairly standard now. You do all the description, all the usual stuff. And then at the end, it's not quite as much. There's usually the barcode. So if you've actually got that molecular evidence in your attribute. So those are the things I need. And I can't thank more the academics who have helped us with this, particularly Nature Metrics, the work back at the University of Kew. My colleagues, ex-colleagues in Natural England, they were absolutely amazing in helping. And the external universities, the whole Edgehill University, doing some of these more futuristic things. So I should leave it there. Thank you.